You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Archaeology Show, episode 294.
On today's show, we talk about prehistoric cannibalism, allegedly, a German soldier in a Roman villa, and sedimentary DNA analysis in Spain.
Let's dig a little deeper into those tasty bits.
Brains.
Welcome to the Archaeology Show.
Hello.
Tacos.
This is the Archaeology Taco Show?
It is.
It's actually not, though.
I know. We're just living in Mexico right now.
Mm-hmm.
So tacos are on the brain.
They are always on the brain here because it's like, when will I get my next taco?
Yes.
It's not today, which is kind of sad. Maybe tomorrow. Tomorrow's taco day.
It's good tacos. Yeah. You know who didn't get tacos?
Maybe they made tacos. We don't know. Well,
they didn't get tacos and they were super mad about it. So they just started eating people.
Oh my God.
All right. So
allegedly.
Polish,
can we just put a big allegedly on this? Please?
Polish cannibals.
Yes.
Okay. I like how they got into it and were like, was this ritual? Let's take another look.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So anyway, what are we talking about? So brain eating cannibalistic community lived in Poland cave 18,000 years ago, bones show.
Mm-hmm.
And this particular article I'm linking to is from Miami Herald, but it was actually linked in a number of different places. So go find your favorite.
Yeah.
But basically, in prehistoric Europe, the Magdalenian culture, which is about 18,000 years ago, this culture was for many thousands of years. You'll hear about the Magdalenians.
Yep.
They were known for their tool making and rock art left behind on cave walls and rocky outcrops. And they lived for thousands of years in what would become Europe and hunted large game.
Mm-hmm.
They also lived together in substantial rock structures in growing populations.
Yeah. And one of these caves that they lived together in was excavated in the 1990s in Poland. And it dates to 18,000 years ago, like you said. And it is called, and you set me up for this note on purpose, didn't you? So I would have to say it.
Have fun with all the consonants.
Masika?
I don't know.
Masika? Let's go with Masika.
It's probably something like Masika cave.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
Anyway, it's Masyka cave.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So.
And they have new research, which they're saying conclusively shows that the people there were cannibals.
So 30 years ago when they excavated, archaeologists didn't actually notice cut marks on the human remains that they found made by tools.
Right.
Because there's, and I feel like I have to say made by tools because they didn't actually get into this in the article and they probably talk about this in the research, but made by tools is a significant phrase because cut marks made by animals
are different. Those are bite marks as opposed to like sawing or
slicing. And
you can tell
the difference because they're generally U-shaped when they're animals because that's how your teeth look. Mm-hmm. And when they're V-shaped, they're generally tools.
Right. Something sharp to actually make a cutting motion.
Right.
A sawing motion, that kind of thing.
And you don't generally jump straight to cannibalism when you hear about that.
No.
Because it could be other things.
It could be other things.
Yeah.
And initial conclusions did point to cannibalism.
Right. Cut marks on human bones.
Exactly. Because like, what else are you going to do? But other analysis, later analysis, refuted this, saying the marks could have been to prepare bodies for burial and also to make ceremonial items out of the bones.
Yeah.
And this is so interesting that this article is what we're talking about, because one of the articles in the third segment, it happens to be from the same time period.
Mm-hmm.
And they legitimately talked about how doing things to the body after somebody died was part of like funerary practices for some of these cultures. So yeah,
not uncommon.
It's not uncommon for them. Mm-hmm. It sounds weird to our modern brains, but they could have been like cutting off fingers to turn into jewelry or like do whatever, you know, there's lots of different things they could have been doing.
But I'm just saying, of course, somebody had a problem with cannibalism and was like, it was probably ritual instead.
Well, we just don't want to think that people are our ancestors. These are our ancestors. A lot of us descended from the people who engaged in this behavior. Right?
I literally just read a book about the sailors on the, which boat was that? The one that basically The one that basically spawned Moby Dick.
Oh, right.
Where, you know, cannibalism. And we've got, you know, Brazilian soccer teams, or not Brazilian, was Argentinian soccer team.
Something, I don't
know.
Like they crashed
down in the Andes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, cannibalism happens, right? Mm-hmm. And it's not uncommon for it to happen way back then.
Yeah.
So anyway,
I feel it's like just, it's more common with like a prehistoric population.
Well,
because survival was more difficult back then, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Anyway, so this recent study wanted to find out pretty much for sure what was going on here. So they reanalyzed the bones and they included some more recent finds that weren't in the original analysis.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't really get into this article what more recent meant, whether that was a few years after the excavation or much more recently. But
right.
It doesn't matter. They're part of the same collection.
Right.
So they were looking at these for, I guess, some more. They originally said they were looking at these for, I guess, from some more reasons for why cannibalism mm-hmm. could be, you know, the case, because mm-hmm. you don't just eat people, you know, unless it's ritual.
Yeah.
But otherwise, you don't just eat people typically.
Typically.
Yeah.
Right.
But it turns out the cut marks, if you just kind of look at where the cut marks were and what parts of the bones they were on and which bones they were on, were aimed at the most nutritious parts of the bodies and not really the more ceremonial cutaway parts of the bodies, right? From other sites where, you know, it is ritual and they're doing ceremonial cuttings, they're trying to cut a body in a certain way. These were literally cut and aimed at the nutritious parts of a body and to get at the tasty bits.
I hear it. I hear you. And I understand where they're coming from. Maybe it's my modern brain just saying that it's unlikely that people would eat people, but mm-hmm. but I'm like, if they had a ceremonial reason or a ritualistic reason that they wanted to cut apart their mm-hmm. dead loved ones, and they already know how to butcher animals because they're doing it to eat the animals, right?
Yeah.
Why would they cut differently into a human than they do into an animal, even though the end result is different? Like they were cutting for ritualistic reasons into the human, but they were still using the techniques that they know because of the way they butcher animals to eat them.
Well, yeah, they're using those techniques, but when they butchered an animal too, they would butcher animals to get to the tasty bits.
Well, yeah, which is why
that's why we know how to do it.
That's why I'm wondering, if they butchered in the same way a human to get to a specific bone that they wanted or a piece of bone, maybe it was just they needed, who knows? Who knows why they were doing it?
Well, in the article they mentioned, for example, they completely ignored feet, mm-hmm. hands, things mm-hmm. like that. There's just no good consumable material on them, right? But in other ceremonial circumstances, fingers and toes and things like that have been shown to be of ceremonial importance.
That's true. That is true.
Yeah.
And they're easy, small bones that, you know, can be yeah. turned into whatever they might want
right.
them to be. So I get that. But I guess I'm just really struggling with this because they don't have actual evidence of humans eating people. They just have evidence of humans cutting other humans
mm-hmm.
similarly to the way that they would cut an animal for butchering and eating. And I'm like, that similarity could be for a reason that isn't cannibalism. That's the part I'm struggling with.
I think what they're matching this up with is that we have a lot of evidence of cannibalism and we have a lot of evidence of the ceremonial mutilation of bodies or mortuary mm-hmm. practices of bodies across the world all the way up until now, from societies all over the place, right? Cultures all over the place. And they're
But cannibalism is fairly rare, I thought.
Rare now. Yeah, sure.
Not even now, but back then too.
Well, that not according to the article. It was less rare in prehistoric times.
Less rare.
But
less rare, for sure. Anyway.
Yeah. But either way, we have enough empirical evidence of how it was done.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter how rare it is. I mean, when you look at the whole of human history, you know how it's done. You know where the tasty bits are.
Yeah.
And you know how to get to it. And when you look at a ceremonial mortuary practices, especially of the Magdalenian cultures, and they have lots of examples of it, it's just different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just different.
It's just really hard for me to.
It's because you don't want to eat people.
I know. Maybe that's it.
You're putting your modern bias on it.
It's my modern bias. But yeah. I get it.
So, well, anyway, more than half or 68% of the bones showed evidence of human manipulation.
Mm-hmm.
They used 3D microscopy, which is super cool, to make a map of the cuts and found that many were indicative of the removal of muscle bundles, mm-hmm. the brain, and marrow from insides of the bones.
Yeah, that kind of evidence is really hard to argue with because, like, even for a ritualistic purpose, why would you be taking the marrow out of the inside of a bone, you know?
Brains.
Like, no, God, stop.
Brains.
Removing the brain is fine because they might want the skull for some reason, for some ritualistic reason. But yeah, the marrow is the one that makes me go, okay, well, maybe it was cannibalism.
Well, another thing leading towards it too is they can tell that cuts were made shortly after death, suggesting they didn't want to wait for decomposition. They didn't wait some graceful period of time.
It wasn't like a lay the body out, let nature take its course, and then, like, come back. Yeah,
this dude's fresh.
Yeah,
let's eat,
like,
him now.
Yeah, we're probably. I mean, they got into the whys a little bit, like, you know, the starving piece, right?
Yeah.
When you're starving, you do crazy things. So, yeah.
So the biggest issue here, as we were just discussing, is differentiating between butchering related to consumption and other types of preparation related to mortuary practices. That's what they were trying to figure out. So, but when they're targeting tasty bits, it seems clear.
God, so horrible.
Yeah.
It's horrible.
So why eat people? If we think they were targeting tasty bits, why eat people? What could have been the possible reasons? Mm-hmm. And we've talked about this, but it could have been a means of survival, having that reason rather than symbolic or ritualistic. And cannibalism, they do mention in this time period, was more common in prehistoric contexts than now, obviously, or later contexts. So.
Yeah, and that makes sense. There's less of the social stigma against it, obviously. There's obviously none of the science about why you shouldn't do it. So, yeah, I guess when people are starving, you know, they will do crazy things, even back then.
Yeah. And they did say that there were competition for resources and, you know, people fighting. And it wasn't too uncommon for them to just, you know, hey, we need food, so you're dead now, you're tasty, so we're
like
gonna
we
eat
got
you.
Into a conflict and now there's all these
we're gonna eat the
dead
enemy.
Bodies
yeah mm-hmm. So I think there was just it seemed like in this, you know, cave people type society, there was just less reverence on the human body,
right?
Yeah, it was still seen more as a resource, you know, and you know, we killed you, therefore you're no longer important to the world and you're food now.
Yeah.
So,
well, it is really interesting, but I do think it's important to point out that this is just one site in one place.
Yeah.
So I don't think that this was like a widespread practice, because we have sites that are this age all across Europe and you don't see this behavior at all of them. So it does seem like some kind of extreme circumstance pushed them to this point, whether it was starvation or resource competition, conflict with another group, like whatever it was. Maybe it really was ritual, but a different kind of ritual, in that they had a conflict with another group and they won. And as part of, like, finishing the winning, they have to eat their enemies. Like, that's possible, right?
Well, it seems like cannibalism throughout human history has always been an extreme circumstance. Nobody's ever, in my knowledge, nobody's ever bred humans for eating.
I don't think so.
You know, like, that'd be something.
That would be
something. It's always been some sort of extreme circumstance, right?
For sure. For
some sort of thing that said, hey, we're not just messing around here. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
Anyway.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, now we are going to go check out a 1500-year-old Roman villa in France where they found a time traveler's wedding ring. All right. Back in a minute. Welcome back to episode 294 of the Archaeology Show.
You sounded very unsure.
That's because I've incorrectly numbered it on my. I'm just noticing that. So.
Oh, on Audition, you incorrectly did it.
Yeah. Oh well, that happens. Well, now I know it's 94. Yep. So, and now you guys do too, but you did already, because you've already heard the intro.
Yes,
I have not.
Yep. That's true. We do the intro last. That's a little piece of recording trivia that maybe people don't know. Yeah. We always do it last.
Incidentally, another little piece of recording inside info, which shouldn't be that inside, because otherwise nobody'd know about it.
Right.
If you're on our Discord server, which you can get there for free, and you can find that on the link tree. You can find it on our website too. I'm actually not sure where.
I think it's in the show notes too for each.
Oh,
episode.
It might be in the show notes. Yeah, yeah, but I know it's on the link tree on our Instagram at ArcPodNet too. So
yeah,
but anyway, it's free, and there's a little bit of a process to sign up. Like, you have to give them your phone number. That's just Discord thing because we were getting some bots in there, so we needed a verification process. Yeah. But anyway, hopefully you can get in, but it's free and it's just a bunch of rooms over there where you can talk about the podcast, things like that. Go join. You don't have to be a member. Mm-hmm. But I'm telling you this because there's live rooms over there, rooms with video. And we are down on a beach in Mexico, and we're actually going to do a live recording of this show, a live presentation of this show with people from our RVing friends,
yes,
in attendance.
When worlds collide. Yeah,
I don't know what's going to happen.
Podcast.
Yeah,
live with archaeology friends. It's going to be great.
It's on the 22nd of February, mm-hmm. and it's at 10 a.m. Mountain Standard Time.
Okay.
So figure that out.
Yeah.
For whatever that means for you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Mountain Standard Time in the United States, and that's just so it's at a decent time.
I think
basically in the United States and the UK. Sorry, Australia.
Yeah.
I don't know what that means for you. It's garbage for you probably.
Yeah,
but
probably the middle of the night. But yeah.
So anyway, hopefully they haven't played beer darts yet by then. It's pretty early.
It's early.
If you don't know what beer darts is, go look it up.
Yeah.
I don't know if you can even find that on the internet, but beer darts is a shocking, shocking game.
That we don't play, by the way, because we're not in college.
We don't play.
No, we do not.
One of us has played once.
And we'll never play again.
Anyway.
Yeah.
So
it should be fun, though. We're in Mexico, obviously. And while we do talk about Mexican prehistory somewhat often on here, it kind of tends to focus on the big cultures. And so what we're going to try to do is deep dive into the area that we're in, actually, and maybe Baja a little bit, because we're sort of connected to we're Baja Sonora area.
Yeah,
in
the
Mexico
state
right
Sonora
now.
That we're in now.
Yeah. So I think we're going to focus there and just like see what kind of cool archaeology stuff we can find out about this area. So that's the plan.
Yeah, there's a lot of cool stuff here because we're literally right next to Arizona, and the history is going to be extremely similar.
Very similar.
Because those people didn't know that it was Mexico and the United States.
Nope. They didn't have any country
boundaries.
They
had no idea.
They just sort of went where the resources were. So
they were all over the place. Mm-hmm. So very similar, I'm sure.
Yep. Should be fun.
Okay. So time travel in France. Let's talk about it.
Are we going with time travel here?
We are.
Okay. So, all right. We are. Go ahead.
And you only find that out at the very end of the article that I'm linking to here.
Are you linking to the Miami Herald again?
Apparently.
Man,
I don't know how that even happened.
You've got some love for Miami Herald today.
Ugh, gross. Anyway. So archaeologists discover a Roman villa in France, then unearth soldier's wedding ring.
Yes.
So, all right. The timeline there is not exactly right.
Yeah, that is a little bit misleading because it's not a soldier from somewhere or some time that you would expect, hence the time travel references.
And so, they also weren't digging and then all of a sudden uncovered a soldier's ring. There's like decades separating these things. So, because they were digging there for a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah, different time periods. But anyway, aerial surveys in the 1970s originally revealed stone structures below the surface in, I don't know how to pronounce this, Soissons in northern France.
Yeah. And the site has a high level of preservation since it's at the bottom of a slope near a river and near the edge of an important ancient road.
Yeah.
So you've got good preservation and also a place where people were, lots of people were over time.
It turns out the stones belong to a villa, a Roman villa, dating to about 1,500 years ago, and is near the Gaelic city of Augusta Susuinum.
Susuinum? Susuinum?
Susuinum?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
That was captured by Caesar in 30 BC and was occupied by the Romans until the 6th century.
Oh, that's kind of a long time. Yeah.
So
the villa is in a classic layout with a 260-foot long boundary wall of limestone, and that surrounds an internal like courtyard area, which by the way is like house goals for me. I want an internal courtyard. Can you put that on the list for like someday when we want to like give up this RV gig? Okay, cool.
No, I think we could make that happen in the RV. If we just make these slides open into like an internal, like make the roof open a little bit.
Oh, so you want to just like pop this like paneling out of the ceiling and
I'll tell you what,
make it a big skylight.
Sort of a dream for that whole roof to open. It's useless, really. I mean, no. Except for our solar panels that are up there.
Well, yeah. We do need those. Anyway. Yeah.
Anyway, the buildings were well constructed and showed signs of reinforcement over time. So, yeah, that's kind of cool.
Yep.
The villa was used for housing and agriculture and held items like axes. I said gouges.
Gouges.
Which I'm not really sure what gouges are. Mm. I don't know if this is like a plow thing or what, but.
Yeah, maybe some kind of farming equipment.
It also said hippo sandal, which I'm not sure if that was. I'm not sure if that was like a plant or something or what, but or some sort of deal.
To protect horse hooves, it says specifically.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
They also found coins and slag. Slag is a byproduct of metalworking.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And all that was found throughout the property.
Mm-hmm. So cool. People living here.
Yeah.
You know, growing crops and stuff. Makes sense.
They also found what they called, in archaeological terms, combustion structures, which is just a fancy term for ovens and a forge.
Right.
Yeah.
And then the slag. So if that makes sense. Yeah. Right. Yeah. An even older network of ditches was uncovered, but that didn't have many artifacts in it. So,
yeah. So then right at the end of the article, you find out that also later on, recently, actually, a grave with human remains was found at the site.
Mm-hmm.
The person didn't seem that old. They still had shoes and clothing buttons present in their burial. So it's not like all their clothes were there, but they had their shoes on. They had buttons, right?
Stuff that would not be present if it was a Roman era burial.
Right. Yeah. Especially if you saw the shoes, you'd been in like, those aren't sandals.
Yes, that's not what they wore.
Right. It was a man and he was carrying a silver cross rosary.
Another thing you probably wouldn't find in a Roman burial.
Right. A pocket mirror.
Nope, definitely wouldn't find that.
Paper, coins. A comb. And now I'm reading this and just listing these things out. And it literally said a Swiss army knife.
Yeah.
And scissors. And I'm like, okay, so the article is going to continue and say some sort of like, this is the Swiss army knife of the Roman legion. Like it's a legit Swiss army knife.
Actual Swiss army knife.
So I'm like, the hell is going on here?
Yeah.
And he was also wearing a wedding ring.
Yeah.
And the ring was inscribed with his wedding date of December 25th, 1908.
Man, getting married on Christmas, that's a choice.
Yeah. It's like, why are you guys celebrating Christmas? It's my wedding day.
Right. Yeah.
So it turns out, because they also found an ID placard on him, which all good burials should have.
I know, right? Thank you for that.
Right.
But by that, did they mean like dog tags?
Or like the German equivalent
of dog tags?
I think they meant something like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. I kind of just like spoiled the surprise. But it was a German soldier from World War One who was buried there. So
it was just, I think, a stroke of
coincidence
that he was buried pretty much at a Roman villa.
Yeah.
But I feel like you could drop a shovel pretty much anywhere in that area and kind of find a Roman villa.
Right.
But I don't know. Anyway, it was just nobody knew that was there when he was buried there in World War One.
Do you think that maybe there's a chance people knew that there was
something there?
Structures there, and either they've been buried since then. It's 100 plus years. So they could have been visible on the surface. And so maybe it was on purpose in some sort of protected way. I don't know.
It's also weird to me that, I mean, that's possible, but it's also weird to me that like one soldier was buried there in World War One. Like, what was his story?
I know.
They're trying to track him down. They're trying to figure out if he's got any modern descendants. What was he doing? What did he do in World War One?
Yeah.
You know, you see these stories of people either getting, he probably wasn't shot down. They did have air resources in World War One, but they were very limited. But was he a defector? You know, did he just end up there and he befriended a French family and then died? Or was he wounded and died there and they buried him?
It's all possible. Like this is technically enemy territory, probably. So either he was there with other German soldiers and something happened to him and he died and they buried him there, which with the care that sounds like was taken with the burial of his body, it seems like somebody went to some effort, which makes you think it probably wasn't the people they were fighting against doing that. But
it seems more likely that the Germans were trying out some sort of technology and he time traveled back to the 5th or 6th century and was literally buried at the
village. And was literally buried there. Yeah, right.
That seems more likely.
I mean, we can go with that. You know, I love a good time travel. There's got to be a romance in there somewhere, too.
Wait a minute.
He met the love of his life in, you know, turn of the millennium Rome.
Actually, I'm sorry. That can't be true because his shoes wouldn't have lasted 1,500 years. So.
Shoes would not have lasted.
Yeah, sorry about that.
And paper. The paper would not have made it that long. So, yeah. Well, okay. But maybe he went back in time, found his Roman lady love. They had their life together. And then he went back to modern times and just couldn't be separated from her. And so he died and then went and buried himself. Well, he had people bury him there. I don't know.
Well, I try to be serious on this podcast. If you want to be joking about it, we'll just move to second three. So, all right.
Wow. just shoot down my theories. That's fine.
Okay. Well, in segment three, we're going to learn about the DNA of dirt and what that means about the Red Lady of El Marón. Welcome back to episode 294
mm-hmm.
of the Archaeology Show. And now we're going to talk about dirt DNA.
Dirt DNA.
And the Red Lady of El Marón.
So, you know,
I've never heard about sedimentary DNA.
No, I haven't. This whole article was new information. And also, this is really funny because in retrospect, we failed miserably at this. But we were trying to like put together a Valentine's Day episode.
We nailed
it. So we started with cannibalism. And then we
eat
found the guy with the wedding ring.
You only eat the ones you love.
You only eat the ones you love. And then segment two was about a guy who was wearing a wedding ring, which in
clearly
retrospect
love.
Is not really like
Valentine's,
uncommon.
Valentine's Day, right
Valentine's.
There.
Valentine's. And now we're going to look at the Red Lady of El Marón because, you know, she's red. So probably has something to do with Valentine's Day.
It all makes perfect sense.
This is such a fail of a theme. We're not even going to acknowledge the theme in like the title or the show notes at this point.
All right, listen, if you want some more behind the scenes information, I first found the cannibalism article and I told Rachel, we need to find two more articles about people eating things they shouldn't. We couldn't find
we
any.
We just couldn't.
Recent ones.
Yeah.
Because we're trying to find current news
articles. We're trying to keep it current. And there's so much good news out there. We didn't really feel like we could veer away from current news. So anyway, but this article is really cool. So I'm glad that we're talking about this.
All right, let's get into it.
Yeah, okay. So there's a cave in northern Spain called El Marón, and they found the remains of a female there. And this happened, so excavations have been going on for like ever in this cave since 1996. And they have found tons and tons of stuff there, evidence of, I think, multiple prehistoric groups over time. And it's clearly just a cave that has been occupied by people, you know, for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 2010, they were still excavating there, and researchers Lawrence Strauss of the University of New Mexico and one of his students, a Spanish student named David Quetzal Solana, they had this hunch to dig behind an engraved block sort of in the back of the cave. I guess because the block was engraved, they thought, well, people be here, so maybe more people be back here.
Sure.
I guess that was the thought process. And really glad they did, because they uncovered these remains of the woman, and they date to approximately 19,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's estimated to have been 35 to 40 years old when she died.
Mm-hmm.
And the name Red Lady comes from the fact that her bones were coated with a non-local ochre, which is a red iron oxide pigment that sparkles with specular hematite, which
so
clearly
cool.
means... She was a vampire.
Well, I mean, just pause on that for a second, because like this article is about her, but it's kind of like not really about her.
Yeah.
And they don't even go into full detail about anything else that because they've done a lot of studies and DNA analysis, and they found bacteria in her teeth and stuff like that. So they've done a lot of analysis on her over the years. But I mean, her bones are red. Like reddish tinged mm-hmm. from this substance that they put on it, which means that they somehow got all of the tissue off of her body and then coated the bones in this color. Either they waited a long period of time or hey, maybe they, you know, butchered a little bit to get the meat off of her bones, for lack of a better phrase.
I'm thinking they snacked on her first.
There's no evidence of that. So probably they didn't. But yeah, just so interesting. Like, And this is the only one in this cave, I think, that is like this, too. So just very, very interesting. I would love to know the circumstances that got to the point where they were preparing a body like this.
Well, and the rest of this article goes more into really the DNA and all the other stuff. So we don't really get into the red ochre and how her bones were coated. But mm-hmm. I really am kind of more interested in that as well, too, because there were a number of burials in Spain, and I want to also say, was it Israel or something like that? Like, that was a Neanderthal burial I'm thinking of specifically, but there's been a number of burials where the burial was covered in like flowers and other various plant materials and things like
that. You're thinking of the Neanderthal child burial that was covered in flowers, yeah.
But I'm just wondering if the type of burial when she was, you know, fully skinned up.
Oh, I see where you're going with this.
Right.
Yeah.
When everything decomposed and the red ochre did not.
Right.
And then, you know, 19,000 years later, the red ochre had just
stained
like
her bones.
Had stained her bones or adhered to her bones in a way. Mm-hmm. Can they really tell that her bones were coated in this material post-mortem? Or did that happen during the burial over the course of thousands of years?
Yeah, I wish we had the answer to that because I don't know. And they don't really go into it in this article. This is from phys.org, by the way, which is usually pretty good on the science bits of things. And this is from an article that was published in Nature Communications, which, to be totally honest, I didn't look at it super closely. So maybe we get more answers there. If you're interested, go look at that. You'll probably get some more answers.
I think later on today, I'm going to troll this town and see if there's any mechanics that are more popular than others and see what they think.
Oh, my God.
Because I don't want to know what the unpopular mechanics
think. I think you should check in with Miami because they're the ones who are doing the hard-hitting articles about
the Miami biology. Herald really knows what's up these days.
This episode is going off the rails. We need to bring it back. So anyway, a new type
of analysis, which they use to basically do this analysis on her, basically to find out all about her, is something we'd never heard of before.
Never heard of it.
Sedimentary ancient DNA, or SEDA DNA, lowercase SEDA DNA.
Right.
And it uses DNA found in the excavation dirt itself, which I always would have thought would have been contaminated all to hell.
Yeah. Well, I wrote that sentence in our notes for us as like a talking point, but I wonder, I'm actually wondering if they didn't actually use the dirt that was excavated from around the body. And this is more from a nearby area. So they're looking at the soil in levels as they go down, right?
Well,
because it's below her too.
No, I understand.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you would have to use samples from around just to get almost an average.
To get the stratigraphy.
To get almost an average. You couldn't just take one sample of this sedimentary DNA from somewhere and call it good. Mm-hmm. You'd have to get a lot of corroborating evidence.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So they have some way that they're taking these samples of the soil to keep it, you know, organized and not be all contaminated and mixed up or whatever.
Not only that, but my God, you would have to, like, I see a person on the wall here in a picture. Mm-hmm. She's wearing gloves and it looks like she's wearing some sort of a headlamp or something like that. But I feel like if you're taking sedimentary DNA, gloves is not going to cut it. Mm. Like, her hair's out, you know, I mean, you're going to really have to cover yourself up if you know that you're taking DNA from the soil. There's no risk for contamination.
Well, they might be excluding modern DNA too. They could do that too, because we know that
modern
people weren't there. Well,
So
also,
anyway,
this is just like it's a sampling procedure on the rear vestibule of the cave.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know. Anyway, they're using this technique to reveal information about the human and animal populations because, I mean, DNA is DNA, that preceded the Red Lady of Mitterrand.
Yeah. And so apparently you can extract human and animal mitochondrial DNA from the sediment. And I guess they were specifically focused on the lower levels of the site, in particular below this burial, because they're trying to figure out what was there or who was there in the cave before her, and then how that could have impacted who she ended up becoming.
Yeah.
I think that was the idea of the study.
Yeah. The results show that several animals not represented by bones from the dig were present, which is interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And just because they were present doesn't mean that they were you don't know why they were present. You don't know if they were alive or if they crawled in there and died, or like what happened, why their DNA is present.
Yeah. What could cause the animal's DNA to be in there? Did it go in there and, you know, take a crap?
Was it just hanging out? Yeah.
I mean,
was it living in the cave, or
was
hair
in there?
Did it, roll through and like shed a whole bunch of, who knows, right?
Yeah.
So, but they were there, they were present, they were part of the landscape. And because they were part of the landscape, they could have impacted the humans that were there too. So I think that's sort of what they're getting at with this it's almost like a big picture analysis that they're doing. And so they also found the humans who made the Solutrean artifacts during the height of the last glacial maximum, which would have been like 25,000 to 21,000 years ago and a few thousand years before our Red Lady. They found the presence of their DNA in the cave, and also that those people had Fornal genetic ancestry. I didn't know. Have you heard of that group before?
No.
There is such a like crazy network of migrating humans all across Europe. So there's just so many different ones and it's hard to keep them all straight. But this is one that I hadn't heard of before. So just a quick look was they're a group of hunter gatherers who lived in Europe during the Ice Age. And they were forced south during this last glacial maximum, which is probably how they ended up their DNA. And anyway, ended up in this cave in Spain.
Glacial maximum is, for those that don't know, is basically the furthest extent of the glaciers during the Ice Age.
Yeah.
So it's the furthest they went. It's not necessarily the coldest or whatever.
Right.
It probably is, but it's just the when they're extending down into the continent, it's the furthest that they went.
Yeah.
So,
and it's what forces both humans and animals out of the way because it's a glacier. Like, it's pretty desolate, right?
Yeah. Now, this statement here, the presence of their DNA in the cave indicates they likely contributed to her genetic makeup. But the fact that people moved around here so much.
Yeah.
I'm a little skeptical of that myself.
I know. That's where they kind of lost me with this. I mean,
they have
like,
DNA. Wouldn't they know?
Yeah.
If that DNA and her DNA. Because they don't really have her DNA, do they? Because her bones are not.
They did actually. They were able to do some DNA analysis
some out of her
on
bones?
Her. Yeah, which they don't really talk about in this article. Again, it was kind of like they just went straight to this sedimentary DNA stuff. But they did get some stuff from her teeth, for sure. They talked about that. What I'm wondering is if they just couldn't get mitochondrial DNA specifically, which this is mitochondrial DNA from the soil. So maybe they're not able to do like a direct comparison. But I don't know. It felt like kind of a reach to me, too, to say that we have evidence that these people were here 2000 years before her. Therefore, they likely contributed to her genetics, you know. But there's like you don't know for sure they stayed around in the area. You don't know for sure that she didn't move in the area from somewhere else. Like, people were migrating and moving around all the time. So this is another one of those things where like, either they're not communicating very well exactly why this does mean that, or it's still a bit of a speculation situation. Yeah.
Well, the set of DNA shows the presence of carnivores. And I'll tell you what, there's a new dog I want to get. apparently, it's a wild dog now confined to the Eastern and Southeastern Asia. And I don't know how you pronounce this. It's D-H-O-L-E, but I'm going to pronounce it D-hole.
I don't think it's D-hole. I think it's probably a dole.
Nope, I'm going to get a D-hole dog. It's not. So I want the D-hole.
All right.
And
you're a D-hole.
Well, there's also there's also leopard and hyena and ungulates like the woolly mammoth, rhinoceros, and reindeer.
Yeah.
Which, I can't wait to see reindeer when we go to Sweden in like less than a month.
Will we see them there?
Oh, there's reindeer everywhere. It's Sweden.
Okay. All right. Cool. I hope we do.
I mean, I don't want to put a damper on this for you, but we're actually going to eat reindeer. It's on the menu.
I did see that. Yeah. That's okay. I'm okay with that.
You're okay with that. So yes, we are going to see reindeer
in
one way or another.
And then we will eat them.
And then we will eat them.
Great. Perfect. Well, back to these reindeer. So the reason that it's interesting that they found the DNA of these species in the Seta DNA is because they were only minimally represented or not at all represented in the artifacts and the bones that they were covered in this cave. So, but again, I'm like, so they were there, they existed, but that doesn't mean that they interacted with the human populations either before or after. So what is this actually telling you other than just creating? It's almost like those cores, like the geologic cores you get, where it gives you this like big picture of everything that was going on environmentally speaking.
Yeah.
But you have to take that and then do something with the information.
No, I think it's fantastic because it shows you exactly that, right? It shows you. Actually, it reminds me of the OLAP project in Tanzania.
Okay.
So when I was there at Olduvai Gorge, the OLAP project was being run by Rutgers University, and it was called the Olduvai Landscape Paleoanthropology Project, I think. I can't remember. I'm probably missing a couple letters there. But basically what they were doing is they said that basically the Leakey family had excavated vertically through time. And what they were trying to do was, well, they had excavated, I guess, horizontally through time in some areas. And they were trying to excavate vertically at those points, right?
Okay, yeah.
So they were trying to figure out, well, what else is going on, I guess, horizontally at these individual points vertically. So they would say, here's a spot at 1.2 million years ago. Well, what else was happening here?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's what I think is telling us here is, yeah, sure, we know that these animals live these time periods, but directly in this cave, who else were these people competing with before and after when they lived there?
Mm-hmm.
You know, before is hard to tell. I mean, unless we dig down to her, but once you dig down to her, you know the before, and you can say layers before that. Okay, great. We know that before they got to this cave, there was this, 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 and this. And it just adds more pieces to the puzzle, paints a bigger picture.
I think so. That really helps me with this because I was kind of struggling to like see how this would change what you know about the remains of a single individual, you know?
Yeah.
But if you can like step back and look at it in this broader context and see the kinds of animals that were in the area, the kinds of other humans who also occupied this cave before, well, and after, they already know because of their excavations, but before, where they don't have any remains, that is interesting because it does feed into her story, the people that and the animals that were there before her. It's just when they say things like that the presence of this other group of this older group of humans, you know, contributed to her genetic makeup, that's where they kind of lose me a little bit, because I'm like, well, you can't say that for sure because of the way human populations were moving around. But
but there were fewer humans.
There were fewer humans. So it does make it more likely.
They say at the end of the article that this particular DNA evidence ranges from 46,000 years ago to 21 to 20,000 years ago, which presents more questions for me just right at the end here, because I'm like, first off, why does it end at 20,000 years ago? Was that was that the end of the cave? Was there no more sediment accumulation, or did they extract it all? Did they dig down to that point and be like, oh crap, we can do this new set of DNA thing and we've ruined all the soil before that?
It might be that. But there's got to be some place in the cave that's untouched where they could.
Maybe. But then also, what is the viability of DNA? How far back can you go with this technique? Because I would have thought even 46,000 years was pushing it.
Right.
Like it would just be unusable at that point. What kind of preservation conditions have to exist, you know, for this to be viable, right? So
yeah,
it's crazy.
It is super crazy. It's very interesting though. I feel like archaeology techniques are expanding to create a much bigger picture than they used to, because it used to be so focused on the artifacts and the one site, and now we have all these ways of doing analysis that fill in like a much bigger picture. And stuff like this, even though I'm still a little unsure about it, it seems like it's a really cool piece that will contribute to the overall context in the future. It's really neat.
All right. Well, with that, taco time.
Taco time.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at ArcPodNet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultural Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.